This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Conversation with someone when they have that revelation, like,
you
just
making
sure that maybe looking at this case, it could be an interesting process piece.
Okay.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This weekend in Atlanta, there's a festival taking place called Many Rivers to Cross. It's billed as a festival of music, art, and justice, and it brings top performers like Chris Rock and Macklemore together with activists like Cornel West and the founders of Black Lives Matter. Many Rivers to Cross is the brainchild of none other than Harry Belafonte and the organization he founded called Sankofa. Now, today, we take for granted more or less that entertainers can speak out and advocate for all kinds of causes. But Harry Belafonte was one of the pioneers. He was at the very center of the civil rights movement, and he was a confidant of Martin Luther King Jr. Later, he worked with Nelson Mandela to bring down apartheid in South Africa. And of course, he was one of the great performers of his era, adored by millions.
Down the way where the nights are gay and the sun shines daily on the mountaintop, I took a trip on a sailing ship, and when I reached Jamaica, I made a stop. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way, won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning around, I had to leave a little girl in Kingston Town.
One of Belafonte's fans is Jelani Cobb, who writes a lot on civil rights issues and politics for The New Yorker.
This is his office.
Just recently, Jelani went to Belafonte's office in Midtown Manhattan, where they were working out the final details of this weekend's festival.
So Mr. Belafonte's office is like an archive.
Hey, how are you?
You know, when you walk in, there are his gold records that are on the wall, and then there are posters from some of his films, and you kind of walk through his biography by looking at what's on the walls. When we got there, we talked for a moment with his daughter. She's really heavily involved in working out the logistical details for the festival.
Now it's just a matter of, pushing our ticket sales and having bodies on the ground.
We were waiting for Mr. Belafonte to arrive, and some people walk into a room and some people make an entrance.
Sir, Mr. Belafonte. Rush through this verbiage just expressed by regrets.
And at 89 years old, Harry Belafonte still makes an entrance. I jokingly told him that a friend of mine, when I mentioned that I was going to be talking to him, I asked her if there's anything that I should ask him for her. And she said, yes, ask him if I can have his phone number. And this is someone who was in her 30s. He now walks with a cane, and he's thinner than he has been, in earlier points of his life. But there's still something really very dignified about him. Sir, it's good to see you.
I got to tell you something. I've discovered it's nice to see anybody.
You know, with Belafonte, it's like picking up an encyclopedia and flipping through the pages. There's so much information there, and there's so much lived experience. Like the fact that he owned a burger joint in the village at some point in his career when he was convinced that he wouldn't make it as an actor.
Yeah. Didn't own it long until he went bankrupt. I didn't charge enough for the hamburgers. And most of the people who came to eat in the restaurant were all my friends, acting students, who also broke and didn't, and said, I'll pay you when I get from my next gig. Well, I got a drawer full of next gigs, no money.
But when you talk to him, you know, he kind of grounds his sense of identity and everything he is, and being the child of two very hardworking but nonetheless disadvantaged West Indian immigrants.
As a young person watching my mother go through the indignities of poverty, she came home too often broken, a broken person. Mm-hmm. She stood in line down onto the L on 3rd Avenue to get day
and
work.
And this is in Harlem?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Something you said that was really interesting, I thought, which is that you said you people think of you as an artist who became an activist, but you think of yourself as an activist who became an artist.
Yes, that's exactly correct.
Mm-hmm.
When people say, when did you become an activist? I just said, well, I don't know how you can ask citizens of color who were born into poverty,
mm-hmm.
when did you become an activist?
Mm-hmm.
You really become an activist the day you're born, because your whole lust and thrust and effort is to get out of poverty, and that requires a lot of work.
One of the more notable things, I think, was the story he told about going to Mississippi with Sidney Poitier to bring $100,000 to civil rights activists there. You know, Sidney Poitier is, of course, the great African-American actor and Harry Belafonte's oldest friend.
I called Sidney Poitier, which I'd been in the habit of doing, for us to go for fun and games.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought this was that kind of call. So when I called him, he said, and I said, I got to go down to Greenwood, Mississippi. And there was this long pause. Belafonte, what are you going to Greenwood, Mississippi for? And I spelt it out.
And so, on the face of it, it sounds absurd. These are two of the most recognizable figures in Hollywood, in American culture at this point, and they are trying to organize a clandestine trip to Mississippi to funnel money to a civil rights organization that can't get it any other way.
When we got to Greenwood, it was one of the darkest nights I've ever remembered seeing. No electricity at all in this little dirt airport. And just at that moment, in a circle around the airfield, these lights went up. And in the distance, there were cars. And I was with a guy named Willie Blue. I had said to Sidney, I think those are the feds. And Willie Blue said, feds my ass. That's the Klan.
Wow.
I looked at Sidney. And he was not in a humorous mood.
It's just really kind of amazing story and kind of the dynamics between the two of them and driving around in the middle of the night and being concerned that the Klan is going to come get them. And it's funny, but it's also poignant. And at 89 years old, it's very easy to just talk about life in the past tense. But I think the other reason why I wanted to talk to Mr. Belafonte was the fact that he is so deeply enmeshed in things that are contemporary and current. He's not talking about things that happened in 1966, except as a means of shedding light on what happens in 2016. Have you been surprised or dismayed by anything that's happened in our current politics that makes this moment particularly important?
Yes. What really stuns me is the absence of black presence in the face of the kind of animus that's being heaped upon us.
Mm-hmm.
To gerrymandered voting districts, to change the voting zones, to close down privileges that are given to workers mm-hmm. who Sundays and weekends to be able to vote. This mm-hmm. onslaught is all about race. Mm-hmm. And there is no real substantial voice coming out of the black movement. Our organizations are fallow. Where is SNCC? Where is SCLC? The NAACP? It is the absence of black consciousness and a black response to these things that I think that has ennobled people, like emboldened them, like
well, Black Lives Matter, I presume.
Well, Black Lives Matter is something we created, mm-hmm. but I'm thinking the Donald Trumps of the world.
Uh-huh.
Where's the black voice? Mm-hmm. Where's the black Congress? Where are the committees? Not individuals, but where's the collective? We don't have a labor movement like we had when we did the March on Washington, because labor movement, by and large, belly-upped. There is no labor movement in this country. There's a labor struggle, mm-hmm. but there's no labor movement. Mm. We have no peace movement.
What do you see the difference between those two things, a labor struggle and a labor movement?
A movement, I think, is an organized body with purpose, mm-hmm. with declared targets, with clarity of philosophy, with an ideology. A struggle is when somebody slaps you and you try to cover yourself from the blow. Mm. There is no underbelly. There's no grit. There's no challenge. And we certainly don't have the political leadership. It's not in the White House. It's not in the Congress. I kind of welcome this.
Mr. Belafonte was trying to orient himself, I think, in time and in a kind of activist space. He began talking about what he saw as the failures of organizations that were led by his contemporaries, and that they left a void that had to be filled by other groups. And I think he was implying that the rise of things like Black Lives Matter was as a result of, you know, I think it's probably not too harsh to say, other people dropping the baton.
There is no voice that stands strong in leading some mighty response, some righteous response mm-hmm. to what's going on.
I think it's important to recognize also the reverence that a lot of younger people have with for Belafonte. You know, John Legend certainly is one of those people, and then, you know, various voices and elements of Black Lives Matter that have been in dialogue with him. And there is a cadre of younger artistic and activist people who see in Belafonte kind of a mentor figure, kind of one of the last vital links to the civil rights movement that much of this work is still inspired by. And I'm not sure there's anyone else who quite occupies that niche.
When I listen to young people like Jesse Williams, when I listen to John Legend step in and speak out, I feel rewarded that somewhere along the line, these are the dividends for what we invested, all my colleagues who are now dead and gone, because I now understand that I'm officially at the end. I don't want to do it anymore.
It was jarring to see him talk about the fact that we all have a finite amount of time here, and he's thinking very much about what it is that he's done.
I am going to spend the rest of my days perhaps being more radical than I ever thought I would ever be, mm-hmm. saying things that are more radical, because I no longer want to lead anything mm-hmm. or be part. I just want to say the truth and what it is. There's a lot of stuff to be said. Where I go with it, I don't know, but we'll be knocking at your door.
I'm always eager to talk to you, Mr. Belafonte.
Okay.
Sounds of laughter everywhere, and the dancing girls swing to and fro. I must declare my heart is there, though I've been from Maine to Mexico. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way. Won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning around. I had to leave a little girl in Kingston Town.
Harry Belafonte, talking with the New Yorker's Jelani Cobb. The festival that Belafonte's group has organized, Many Rivers to Cross, is this weekend in Atlanta. Ahead this hour, John Lee Anderson heads deep into the Amazon to witness a once-in-a-lifetime encounter. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm David Remnick. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks so much for tuning in. John Lee Anderson is one of the most incredibly intrepid people you could ever meet. He's reported on war zones and four continents for the New Yorker and other publications. And he acquired his comfort with travel very early. His father was a diplomat and Peace Corps official, and John Lee was raised in half a dozen countries. When he was a young man, long before he went into journalism, he took himself to a remote part of the Amazon jungle in Peru, journeying up the river called Madre de Dios.
I had an unusual upbringing. I had an inordinate admiration for people who were able to do things with their hands, to hunt, to live off the land. And from a quite young age, 11, 12, I had been trying to do it. My parents had tried to facilitate it where they could. So I spent a year in Africa when I was 13. And I'd spent a year on the Mosquito Coast, 17 and 18, living and working as a machetero, as a peasant, earning a dollar a day with Garifuna people on the coast of Honduras, and learning how to climb coconut trees and use a machete and to fish in a dugout canoe. And I had a great admiration for people that knew the forest, knew the wilderness, and could survive in it. I felt like I was a city boy wanting to learn the original secrets of life. It's funny because I realize as I'm talking about this that this is the stuff of, you know, adventure tourism and even television shows now. And it just wasn't then. I first went to the Madre de Dios when I was 20 years old, so it was in the late 70s, with an idea to go upriver to where, you know, in those days we still talked about wild Indians. And I was pretty gauche, and I thought that would be, it was something I'd always wanted to see. I wanted to see the original world. I was young, I was not yet a journalist. I had had a couple of years at college and left to go to South America to explore. So I hired a man to take me upriver into what was called the Manu Forest. It had recently been declared a national park. It's part of the river head of the Amazon, in the corner of Peru, neighboring Brazil and Bolivia. It's a vast region, a kind of an amazing biosphere that is also home to some of the world's most isolated people. And I camped on a sandbar near an Amaricaire indigenous village. I'd been told that they were unfriendly and they weren't hostile, but they were. They didn't meet my eye. I knew that they were not happy at seeing me there. I now realize that what I was seeing was a community that had been devastated in the previous half century. The Amaricaire had been one of the great warrior tribes of the region. By the time I went there, there were about 500 left. I wanted to go further up. This was still the main river. I wanted to go off into the tributaries. It was like getting off from a highway onto a trail, really. And we did. We went up the Manu River, which is then into the national park. I forget whether it was our first or second night up the river, but these are long days in the canoe. And there were suddenly two men on the shore. I remember them as incredibly strong, fit men. One in particular, I'll never forget, he had this black hair. It was like a mop on his head, and it was cut ragged around his shoulders. And they were standing over a dead peccary, a wild boar. And my boatman hesitated, but we stopped. We hadn't had meat. In the end, we had a meal with these two men who were, for me, of an unknown tribe, and we had no means of communication, and they just stared at me all the time. And at one point, I remember looking across at this one man who particularly fascinated me because he was so strong looking. He'd cut off pieces, and we were eating them, and he had the actual bone, the actual shank, and was holding it with his feet, and with his arms, he was chewing off the rest. And I thought to myself, this is a glimpse of ancient man. There we were. That was it. I returned to the Madre de Dios this time because of the mysterious appearance over the last several years of the Mashcopiro Indians. For almost 100 years, they remained in the forest. And, there were occasional appearances, but it wasn't until the last 4 or 5 years that the Mashco had been repeatedly coming out. Even adventure tourists had begun to see these people who would appear on the riverbank. In some cases, they would be threatening. In other cases, they would be just staring at them. There was an incident in going back to 2011 where they killed a man. In the years since then, there had been more and more sightings of them. And then suddenly, this last year, they killed, with a bow and arrow, a young man in a village of Machigenga Indians. Now, the extraordinary thing is, as I say, that for about 80 to 100 years, the Mashco had disappeared into the forest. Now, suddenly, they're coming out. So anthropologists and others, the zeitgeist is full of papers and findings and debates about what's going on. Why are these people coming out? They're now prey to drug traffickers, to men seeking hardwood timber, which is worth, hundreds of thousands, a single tree, and so on, gold, diamonds. The speculation was that the Mashco were coming out in distress, that they were coming out because they can no longer survive inside. There was a kind of growing consensus and an alarm spreading that perhaps, it is the end time for these people. So the Mashco coming out forced the government to address the situation. So that meant that the government, through its culture ministry and its recently created Office of Isolated and Uncontacted Indigenous Peoples, staffed by a handful, literally a handful, of young anthropologists with almost no budget whatsoever, now we're forced to consider making contact with the Mashko to find out what the problem was, why they were attacking, why they were coming out. And so they began last summer to make what they called expeditions of controlled contact. They have an outpost on the river, and through native interpreters from the Jine tribe, who are basically cousins of the Mashko, they've convinced them to make their appearances there. The outpost is up a high bluff, and there's a longhouse there with a water tank and a generator. And they have a bench on the edge of the bluff, and they spend their days looking across to see if there's any appearance by the Mashko. The first time I saw them, I saw a mass of naked people standing against the white scree of rock of the far riverbank. This was maybe the fifth or sixth they had had in such encounter when the scouts and the anthropologists arrived on land. They were immediately besieged by the group in a friendly way, because they knew them now, particularly by the children who climbed on them. They were inspecting them. They searched their bodies. I noticed that one of the scouts, one of the Jine women working with the anthropologist, is named Nelly. She's quite a chubby woman. And I noticed that the women were sort of kneading her breasts. And then Rommel, the sort of lead Jine scout interpreter, we watched as the children sort of made him run with them and do races. Anyway, there was all of this milling around. There was a lot of playing. You could see that they were also making faces to one another. Usually this would be the children with Rommel. The adults would come up and watch this. And then sometimes they would join in too. And I could see the anthropologist asking questions. Back at the camp, back at the post, I asked Nelly what was going on. And then she said, well, they saw how fat I was. And they said, you're pregnant. And I said, no, I'm not pregnant. I'm just fat. They didn't know what that was. And one of the women said, well, I am. And she squeezed her breasts and squirted her breast milk in Nelly's face.
Así, las chicas lo hicieron así. No les has visto, estaban ahí con sus tetas. No me digas.
It was this kind of haphazardness. But they had begun to get pretty much register who was who. They knew who the leader was, and he was there that day. I immediately recognized him. A young man, about 22, tall, called Kamotolo. And they talk a lot about Kamotolo. They say that Kamotolo seems to understand that the outside world is right there, that it has certain benefits. He'd always expressed a lot of interest in their canoe. He would often go and sit in it. Two things that had emerged. The Mashko did not swim and could not fish. They had no canoes. They lived in the forest. So this is very unusual. But so far, they'd been frustrated in discovering why they were coming out. The team, you know, they worried about the fact that they weren't in full control of this idea of a kind of pure contact. The lead anthropologist, who was Luis Felipe Torres, a young guy, was full of sort of self-doubt about whether or not this was a good thing, but he didn't know what else to do. It had fallen upon them to look after these people. So, you know, here you have had a young, you know, progressive Peruvian from the city who'd learned anthropology, but felt a moral quandary about whether what they were doing was ultimately right. They were having to respond to them because they had killed someone, because there was a clamor from the communities where these people had been killed that these people needed to be reined in. after this visit. For the first time, I saw the kind of fragility of their existence there and their vulnerability to the outside world, because there was a doctor who was part of the group as well, and he was really concerned because he said two of the women had coughs. And he began to work on a kind of an emergency plan in case they had begun succumbing to flu. And he told me there was a 3-day rule with indigenous communities. I asked him what he meant by that. He said they begin dying within 3 days. The children in particular begin to die just like that. They drop like flies within 3 days. He said he knew that eventually there would be an epidemic and it would be devastating to the Mashko. So they agreed to come back again. We'd been waiting for them. It was the day they were supposed to come, and they didn't show, they didn't show, they didn't show. And then finally, I heard this excited roar, and there they were. But this time it was different. This time, only 3 men appeared. Kamotolo, another, and a boy. And the older man walked sideways to the edge of the forest to a group of bushes, and he kind of hid himself there. The anthropologist was really worried, and he said, you know, this doesn't look good to me. They might be planning an attack. Where are the women? And he explained to me that in the history of these encounters, this kind of controlled contact thing, that in the past 40 years there have been 60 scouts killed by indigenous peoples, and usually the attacks occur at this stage in the contact. As they were getting ready to go in the boat, the women appeared, and the children. What I felt I saw on this trip was a glimpse of the original world as it's ending. People are no longer metropolitan, you know, urban Americans, Peruvians, everywhere are losing primary experience. We're no longer having direct contact with the original world. Where I was, it's still there. The very original world, before all of our history, before Columbus, before Christ, before all of that stuff, how we were when it was just us and nature, it's disappearing, and it probably will disappear, if not in our lifetimes, in our children's lifetime. It's going. The Mashko Pito are coming out of the jungle. There's only 100 isolated groups left in the world. 70 of them live in this area of Peru and Brazil. This is it. This is the end. That's an extraordinary thing.
Staff writer John Lee Anderson. You can find his article about the emergence of the Mashko Piru at newyorkerradio.org. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. The New Yorker's Nick Niarchos was in the nation of Djibouti in East Africa recently, reporting on refugee camps there. And he came across something pretty unusual. He met a man, a kind of outsider artist, who's building what he calls a museum in the refugee camp, and working with scraps and salvage, trying to create a thing of beauty in the middle of a very grim situation.
That's a bomb.
That's a bomb. Exactly.
And amidst all this, the artist has managed to keep his sense of humor.
Can you tell me a bit about your life when you were in Adan as a child?
When I was as a child?
Yeah, for your life beforehand.
I was more handsome than you. Believe me.
I'm sure.
I was very, very, very handsome.
We'll hear his story next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I'm here with my colleague, Andrew Marantz. Now, Andrew, you watch a lot of comedy. You recently wrote a profile of the comedian, the SNL comedian, Leslie Jones. And I hear a lot of conversation in the halls about all the hot buttons that keep getting pushed in comedy. Who decides where the line is, what the line is? It seems in motion all the time.
Yeah, and it's the job of comedians to push those boundaries. And then the question becomes, okay, what's too much? Two of the people that I often end up talking to about these things are Emily Nussbaum, who's the magazine's TV critic, and Gia Tolentino, who writes for the website. And Gia had just written this great piece about Amy Schumer. One of Amy Schumer's writers, Kurt Metzger, had come to the defense of another fellow comic who had been accused of rape. And in coming to his defense, Metzger had said a lot of really inflammatory things. And so we just wanted to talk about all the issues that were raised by that whole incident.
So Amy Schumer released a book called The Girl with the Lower Back Tattoo, and it was a book of comic essays. And the day it was released, she got in trouble with the internet for a writer of hers named Kurt Metzger, and Upright Citizens Brigade Theater just banned a performer who had been accused of rape, and Kurt Metzger wrote a screed about basically mocking the women who had accused him, but not publicly, basically implying in very vehement terms that there was no reason to believe these women. And
this is him on his personal Facebook.
This is him on his personal Facebook. The show is not, the writer's room is not in session right now, but he has been a liability to Amy Schumer ever since 2013, which is when the rape joke discussion was still going strong after Daniel Tosh had gotten, he said, heckled by a girl in his audience who said that she didn't want him to keep talking about rape jokes. And he said, wouldn't it be funny if that girl got raped by like five guys right now? And then that started a thing. And Kurt Metzger had defended that at length.
I mean, this conversation and debate about humor about rape, about what's offensive, about what's anti-feminist, about what's feminist, about women comedians and lady comedy and the rise in comedy about sex and all that kind of thing seems to have exploded in the last 5 years. And a lot of that is not just because of Amy Schumer, who has this fantastic show that does a lot of jokes about sex, about rape, about women, about feminism, but this real explosion of bold female humor on these subjects. And the fact that a lot of these comedians, from Amy Schumer to Lena Dunham to Abby and Alana on Broad City, there's a bunch of different people. There's Ali Wong. There's who are all of the different people that are out there. I mean, it's real explosion of voices have also been claimed for people as role models and spokespeople for feminism. And I think that tension between somebody as a public female comedian and somebody as a role model during a period when people are talking about rape as a political issue is what's created this huge charge.
it was easier back when it was kind of like you were on a stage or you were off a stage. And now Twitter is this kind of quasi stage.
It's a really good point.
Where some comedians only use Twitter as a joke workshopping tool. Other people, comedians or otherwise, use Twitter as a like, this is just my thought about this thing and it's in no way a joke. And then some people blend the two. Sometimes someone like Sarah Silverman will be like, hey, I had a breakthrough in therapy today. And then other times she'll be like, why does my dog poop so weird? And like, it's like kind of a joke and kind of not. So you have multiple layers of like, okay, thing that is not a joke. Thing that's just a guy at the bank yelling racist stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you have another layer that's like, okay, it's structured as a joke. It just doesn't function as a good joke.
Yeah, there's no joke at all.
And then there's this thing of like, It was structured as a joke. It was intended as a joke. It just sucks.
It's part of what is interesting about this clash is that during the time of the rise of feminist comedy and female comedy, which are not the same thing but are connected, there's also been this explosion of online anti-woman and right-wing politics that are presented as funny memes and jokes and Holocaust references that are actually supposed to be ironically funny and things like that. I think it's part of the reason that it makes it very hard to respond to this sort of trolling is that it's not really framed as any kind of serious argument. It's framed as something to demonstrate that you have no sense of humor, which is Trump's whole thing.
Totally. Like, what was the one that he said? Oh, Obama was the founder of ISIS. Oh, nobody gets sarcasm anymore.
Right.
And then they're like, oh, you're being sarcastic? And he's like, no, I wasn't. So, like, it just becomes this cover-up where you can just be like, oh, you don't get me. You, like, grow a thicker skin, get a sense of humor.
Also, can I just intervene for a second? I know there are going to be people listening who are like, what are you doing to jokes? This is a stupid way to respond to jokes.
Totally.
People shouldn't talk about whether jokes are offensive. I mean, there's a tension in it as well that's about the idea that people should simply absorb jokes and humor, and that humor is in a special category where you physically react to it by laughing or crying or losing control of your body, essentially, and it has to do with this primal thing that's almost musical between you and the comedian, and that then to take your politics and take apart the words and say, where's the power? Are they punching up? Are they punching down?
But I guess so. I know exactly what you're saying. And I also think that the reason to take them apart is to understand your animal musical response, right? Because when it's offensive, but you laugh, then it's a different joke than, you know, like, yeah. I think the point of picking apart a joke and ruining,
you know, I actually have this vivid memory of, this is a long time ago, going to a comedy club when I was in college. And it was in a largely all white club in rural Ohio, and this guy told a joke that was about black guys having big and then he tells this joke. It gets a big laugh because it's a sexual joke. When you work blue, it gets a titillated laugh. People are on dates. And then he ends the joke by saying, you know, doing my part, just keeping the myth alive. Like, he basically did a bit that showed that he knew it was a racist joke about sexual myths about black men. And I remember being so disgusted because I was like, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah.
Like, you've made a choice to use the joke, and now you're trying to sound like a guy who was doing a meta joke, and that won't work. And it did make me very interested in that question of, like, what is the goal of what the comedian's trying to do
totally.
In getting people to respond?
So what happens in the world if you go to that comedy club, this guy tells a racist joke, everybody laughs, and then you go, that was weird, and you go home, and you don't think about it? Like, what is our defense of why we are deciding that something is or isn't okay to say?
I mean, to me, it's because I love comedy, and I want comedy to be penetrating and original and say things about the world. Like, people who believe comedy is great and can be this philosophical art form, I feel like that's part of the reason to talk about if you think it has such a big effect. I remember how excited I was when I first saw Sarah Silverman, because I felt like she was doing this thing of telling this kind of offensive joke that was so well crafted that it had all these multiple sides in terms of jokes that are offensive but make you laugh anyway. I remember her telling that joke where she was like, you know, when I was a teenager, I was raped by a doctor, which for a Jewish girl is a very bittersweet thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I know people were offended just by the subject matter and by the idea that a Jewish girl being raped by a doctor would be like, Jewish girls want to be with doctors. Like, when you take it apart, you understand what the joke is about.
Right.
But I also felt so personally thrilled watching the joke coming from her.
Well, and it's also, I mean, it's a distinct and very interesting case for the progressive but very effective female comedians, where the better their jokes, like, the more politically sharp their jokes are, the harder they'll be held accountable for everything associated with them that's not as good as their jokes politically.
Well, to me, a lot of this is, it's a problem of female culture.
Yeah.
Like, there's a real
desire
for aspirational role models. I'm not saying that's not understandable,
I don't find it understandable at all. I mean, I do, but not really.
I bridle at it a little bit because of the sort of go-girl, rah-rah dynamic.
It's a trap.
Which it is. It's a trap. It doesn't allow the comedians and the artists to simply be flawed, weird creators.
Yeah,
and
it's
part of the marketing.
If you write a memoir, and the memoir is about how people can learn from your career, and then that the week your memoir comes out, you're called to account for creative decisions you made in your career, which include employing a guy who says stuff that's entirely counter to everything you've built your worldview on, then you'll be called to account on it in a different way than if you hadn't written the memoir.
It's true. And on the Amy Schumer Show, some of my favorite skits are the ones that actually do have this meta quality about how self-abased female comedy can be.
Yeah.
Like, did you see the episode where she plays this? One of the first skits on the show. It's where she's auditioning to be in the Two Girls, One Cup video.
Yeah.
And the thing that's so great about it is absolutely disgusting. I refuse to describe what the Two Girls, One Cup video is, but it's a disgusting viral video.
I've never watched it.
I've never either.
We are unified.
Yeah.
In any case, it literally is a sketch about somebody who is about to appear in a disgusting scat porn video and just keeps trying to justify it as some kind of feminist experimental
art. Or the gangbang sponsored by Seabreeze or whatever.
The gangbang is another one. And one of the things that her show is best at is actually puncturing the delusional quality of certain kinds of female performances of freedom as actually incredibly self-abasing. And that's just a rare and original thing to do. And if she gave a speech saying it, it would really be kind of fine, but a little tedious. Part of what I feel a lot of these creators that we're talking about are trying to do is forge a new kind of female voice that actually talks about all of these questions, including rape stuff, and makes it part of the material instead of part of the target.
The New Yorker's Emily Nussbaum, along with her colleagues Gia Tolentino and Andrew Moranz. You can find some of their articles about comedy, about Amy Schumer, and a lot more at newyorkerradio.org. How well does Siri know you? Or Cortana? How about Alexa? Alexa is the friendly name Amazon has given to the voice recognition program in the device called Amazon Echo. Amazon Echo is a little black tower that sits in your home, always on, always listening for your voice commands, waiting to give you information, play music, or, maybe no surprise here, order whatever you need from Amazon. The New Yorker's Sarah Larson found that living with artificial intelligence turned out to be somewhere between 2001 and the Golden Girls.
All right, here's my box cutter. I'm cutting open the box.
It really is rather small.
It's like the size of a large bottle of saline solution. Plug the power adapter into Echo and then into a power outlet. A blue light ring will begin to spin around the top. That's exciting and weird. This is freaky.
You've connected to Echo. Go ahead and finish the setup in your Alexa app.
I don't like that that's our first real conversation, but okay. Oh, now there's a short video.
To get your Echo's attention, say the wake word Alexa. For example, you can say, Alexa, what's the weather?
Alexa, what's the weather?
In New York, it's 78 degrees with clear skies and sun.
This is awkward, but we're just getting to know each other, I feel like. So, Alexa, play the Velvet Underground.
Shuffling music by the Velvet Underground.
Underground. Oh no, it's live. Actually, it might be. It's kind of fun. This feels like it belongs in my house.
At this point, what else do you think you might use?
Well, it would be fun. Definitely when I'm cooking, which does not happen much, but when I do, you know, you're using your hands and you're kind of shuffling around with all these different ingredients, and I think it would be really fun to have, first of all, I'm terrible with weights and measures, and to have, you know, those things answered. And also recipes, I don't know.
But honestly, how many times a year are you going to be like, hey, Alexa, What's a teaspoon?
U.S. customary measure of volume defined as 1/6 a U.S. fluid ounce, or just under 5 milliliters.
How many times a year are you really going to do that?
Alexa, how many times a year am I going to do that?
Sorry, I can't find the answer to the question I heard.
Maybe you're asking her too much about what she can do rather than just telling her what she ought to do.
Alexa, take a note.
What can I add for you?
Ideas for a farce.
Ideas for a fart added to your to-do list.
I said farce. I love that that's all that's on my to-do list right now. Oh, boy. Alexa, good morning.
Good morning. Today is International Literacy Day. I love reading. In fact, it's how I spend my time when I'm not talking to you.
Ugh. Alexa, what's the next book that I should read?
I'm not quite sure how to help you with that.
Alexa, tell me about International Literacy Day.
Sorry, I can't find the answer to the question I heard.
I knew she wasn't reading when I'm not around. Okay, signing off. So I've been thinking about what I want from this column that lives in my apartment, and this is going to sound dorky, but it's really improved my relationship with my playlists. I'm obsessed with making playlists, so I can lie in bed and yell for my Good Morning playlist. Alexa, play Spotify Good Morning playlist.
Good morning from Spotify.
I really like that. Alexa, stop. I also realized that I can yell things out willy-nilly. I was writing a piece from home about ghosts and Halloween and stuff like that, and I suddenly really wanted to hear Monster Mash. So I said, Alexa, play Monster Mash.
Monster Mash by Bobby. Boris, pick it from Prime Music.
And I proceeded to dance to the entire song and then get back to work.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise, he did the monster mash.
Hi.
Hello.
You've been living with her for a while.
Yeah. Well, I was living with Alexa, who should light up when I mention her name, but why didn't she? I was living with Alexa for a while in June, and then I went away for a few weeks in July and did not bring her with me.
Did she feel left out?
She gave me the silent treatment. Oh, my God. That's like an Alexa-level joke I just made to you. That's terrible. I just told her to play me a joke. Alexa, tell me a joke.
Why are elephants wrinkled? Have you ever tried to iron one?
I think her pacing's off.
I think you're right. I could do this all day. Alexa, tell me a joke.
Why was the broom late? It overswept.
One of the creepier things about it is that there's this app on your phone that it interacts with, and it stores every command or question you ask it. And I just think that is incredibly weird.
It's also a bit like a bad girlfriend who's like keeping tabs on you and gonna...
I'm sorry if I did anything to make you feel that way. It wasn't my intent.
Exactly. Always listening. Always weighing in. However, you know, I do have to have playlists and I do have to interact with digital music and stuff. And for doing that, I really like... just being able to yell things out.
because then you don't end up getting lost in your phone or on your laptop and so on.
Oh, so it's like a way to unhook.
Yes, exactly.
By getting closer to the internet, you are in fact further from the internet.
Exactly.
So what else? Are there ways in which she has been less useful?
Well, so when you're setting up your account, there are all these different sources of information you can kind of program into it and hook up to it. And there was one that was news from my home state of Connecticut, and I was excited to kind of keep in touch with Connecticut a little bit. And then every morning I would just get, you know, a list of all the car crashes and, you know, houses that had burned down in Connecticut. And that was terrible. It was like the local evening news, but of Connecticut, and voiced by a robot, you know, which is absolutely not what you want from the future or the present. My apartment was burgled last summer, and somebody came in through an open window, and it was kind of freaky, and I didn't see the person, but every time when I come home, I have this impulse that someone is in my apartment, or just kind of a slight fear that someone is. So I had this brilliant idea that I would have something I would yell out to Alexa after I turn the key, open the door, and walk in, that would change the mood inside the apartment and kind of create a new ritual to distract me from my anxiety. And it totally worked. So, Alexa, play Spotify I'm Home playlist.
I'm home from Spotify.
I'm coming home, baby, now. I'm coming home now, right away.
Isn't this fun?
I'm coming home, baby, now.
It's fantastic.
I'm sorry now I ever went.
So now when I come home and that fun song starts playing, it just sort of feels like a party, and I can kind of laugh at myself, and I know that there's no one in my apartment, and I'm just, it's homey, and I'm having fun, and everything is fine.
Or at least if there is somebody here, you've given them lots of warning that you're home. And a soundtrack.
They can just dance on out of here. Leave me alone.
What about cooking?
Oh, yeah. Well, once I start cooking, I'll let you know. Alexa, how do you make paella?
Sorry, I don't have the answer to that question.
What? Alexa, how do I make kale
and cheese? Oh. Increases macaroni 4 tablespoons, butter 1/4 cup, all-purpose flour 1/2 teaspoon, salt 1/8 teaspoon, ground black pepper 1 cup, half and half or light cream 1 cup, milk 1 teaspoon, brown mustard 2.5 to 3 cups, shredded cheddar cheese 1 cup, soft bread crumbs tossed with 1.5 tablespoons melted butter, preparation, heat oven.
Alexa,
to 3 cups.
Stop. That was like in 2001 when Hal just starts like breaking down and remembering his childhood and have this sort of meltdown. Also, I think Alexa knows, even though I said kale, knows who I really am, because I'm obsessed with mac and cheese and it takes everything I can do to not eat it all the time. I don't, but I wish I could. And she just started yammering about mac and cheese. Oh, well, at least I have a friend for the apocalypse.
That's The New Yorker's Sarah Larson, along with Sarah Nix of The New Yorker Radio Hour, and the charming Alexa, of course. And that's it for The New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. Next week, political strategist David Axelrod and television strategist Kenya Barris, creator of Black-ish. Till then, I hope you have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Alex Barron, Becky Cooper, Johnny Vince Evans, and Eric Malinsky. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.